The first case on our calendar is 04-485, State of Ohio versus Donald Ketter. Mr. Tkatz, Ms. Tkatz, excuse me.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, my name is Ruth Tkatz, and along with Timothy Payne, I represent the appellant, Donald Ketter. I'd like to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal. Imagine being charged with aggravated murder, which carries a penalty of death. You have a major mental illness with psychotic features, including paranoid thinking and auditory hallucinations. You've been admitted to psychiatric hospitals over a dozen times in the past few years. Your cognitive functioning is low, and you have a long-term chronic drug and alcohol addiction. In other words, on your best day, your judgment is clouded and your mental capacity is impaired and below that of the average person. Your court-appointed attorneys, on whom you rely to safeguard your interests and to steer you on an effective course, advise you to forego a jury trial on all the charges and instead plead guilty to every count and specification in the indictment, all without securing a plea bargain. Their advice, even after the trial court denies their motion to present the penalty phase to a jury, plead guilty to everything. Of course, there remains a high risk that a three-judge panel will impose a sentence of death, and one day you may die at the hands of the state. Those are Donald Ketter's disturbing circumstances. Without apparent regard for due process or for their client's life interest, defense counsel encouraged Mr. Ketter to waive his rights and plead guilty to the indictment as charged. He now awaits execution on Ohio's death row. The defense attorneys proceeded with a guilty plea, knowing that the trial court would bar their request to try the mitigation phase to a jury. The tactical advantage they admittedly sought never materialized. But that didn't stop them from having their client waive his right to a jury trial. When the reason for the guilty plea became moot, because the request wasn't granted, counsel never revised their approach to the case. They simply had Mr. Ketter put his life in the hands of a three-judge panel rather than a 12-person jury.
Counsel, from a standpoint of procedure, how would you achieve what they sought to achieve?
That's the difficult question. They argued under Ring versus Arizona that they were entitled to have the jury decide the penalty phase because at the time Mr. Ketter pled guilty to the aggravated murder and the specifications.
At what point can they make that argument?
I'm sorry?
At what point can they make that argument?
They made the argument before the jury was impaneled. I don't know if that's the appropriate time or not, but they advised Mr. Ketter to plead guilty. They approached the trial court. The morning trial was to begin and said, we would like to have Mr. Ketter plead guilty to the indictment, but have the penalty phase presented to a 12-person jury. And the trial judge said, under the statute and under Criminal Rule 11C, I can't do that. So they made, they preserved their issue by making their argument. And when the trial court said, you can have your penalty phase to a jury, you can concede guilt if that's what you want to do in front of the jury, and then have that mitigation to a jury, defense counsel said, no, we'll just go ahead with the plea to the three-judge panel and then the penalty phase to the three-judge panel, thereby numerically reducing Mr. Ketterer's chances of receiving a life sentence. Mr. Ketter had...
So that was then scheduled for a later point in time?
The trial was scheduled for that morning, the morning that they approached the court with this hybrid procedure.
But everybody was sent home then?
The jurors were upstairs. No voir dire had occurred. Defense counsel did not engage in any voir dire before making this decision to have their client plead guilty. The prospective jurors were upstairs waiting for voir dire. I don't even think that the juror questionnaire had been filled out. I think that's what they came to the court to do that morning. And Judge Oney, the trial judge, said that, you know, we have jurors upstairs and you can proceed this way. Now, defense counsel and the prosecutor stipulated that they did not have to actually impanel a jury for trial counsel to preserve this issue. Because what they would have done is impanel the jury, then make their motion to the trial judge, and then, if it was denied, dismiss the jury and say we're still going to go ahead with the plea to the three-judge panel and the penalty phase to the three-judge panel. but between the two parties, they stipulated that the jury did not actually have to be impaneled for them to preserve the issue. Mr. Ketter had nothing to gain and everything to lose, including his life, based on this advice from his trial counsel.
Is there any empirical data that indicates that a three-judge panel is more likely to order the death penalty than a jury is to recommend it?
I don't know of any empirical data, Your Honor, but I just based on the cases that we see, more often than not, a three-judge panel is likely to impose death. I mean, when you consider the factors involved, and there's no indication in the record that defense counsel really, logically went through this. It seems that it was a very hasty decision on their part, and they talked to Mr. Ketter just the night before he was supposed to go to trial, not giving him sufficient time to really digest his attorney's advice and to evaluate the consequences of waiving his rights. But in terms of what you would want to look at if you were going to make that decision, first, what kind of a case do you have that you would want to present it to a three-judge panel rather than a jury? And what mitigating factors do you have? A jury is going to be more likely to be receptive to mitigating factors than judges are going to be, generally speaking.
What do you base that on?
Common sense, for the most part. And when you look at most of the cases, I mean, trial judges, and in fact—
Well, the chief just asked, is there empirical data to indicate that a three-judge panel routinely, uniformly applies the death penalty as opposed to a jury?
That I don't know, but lead defense counsel in this case said during his mitigation closing argument that he had never argued such a case to a three-judge panel before, so he had no experience and no track record with a three-judge panel in this context.
The only three-judge panel I sat on gave life. They didn't give death, so, there's refutation right there for your theory, and the troubling thing about your position is that it almost asks us to find that a strategic decision to go to three-judge panel is an effective assistance of counsel.
No, I'm asking this court to look at the particular circumstances of this case.
And looking at the particular circumstances, you have a person with a pretty heinous fact pattern in the murder with some severe mental issues, and maybe jurors don't have a very good track record of being sympathetic to issues of mental illness, and maybe they believed that a three-judge panel would be able to look at the law more clearly than a jury that could be inflamed by passion. And that would be a sound strategic decision.
But you have to look at who Mr. Ketterer was and what evidence there was in this case. Who were they dealing with?
But your client confessed. They're looking at a trial of a killing of a 78-year-old or 85-year-old gentleman by someone 53 years old who confessed to doing it. I mean, what would the community think of facts like that? And then, as Justice Stratton points out, in mitigation have to consider maybe something that the judges might be more sophisticated to understand in terms of mental illness. It doesn't seem as though it's a flawed trial procedure.
Except that the three-judge panel did not consider Mr. Ketter's mental illness, which is bipolar disorder, a severe mental disorder. He also has personality disorder with borderline features. They did not consider it as a B3 mitigating factor, even though both psychologists who testified said that it was, and that was uncontradicted. They considered it as B7. So they did not give that kind of weight to his mental illness, whereas a 12-person jury may have. Trial judges hear these cases all the time, and even if it's not in the capital trial context, just in criminal felony cases, you have defendants who have substance abuse histories, psychiatric histories. The prosecutor, in his penalty phase closing argument, said this court has years of experience on which it can base its decisions. In arguing Mr. Ketter's crack cocaine addiction as a mitigating factor, defense counsel argued to the three-judge panel, you see it every day in your courtroom. So it's nothing new for judges. And that's the risk in taking a capital trial to a three-judge panel, that mitigation evidence loses its impact.
Counsel, let me ask you, these attorneys on the trial level, were they death penalty certified?
I believe so.
So they were trained and had taken the appropriate seminars in order to get that designation to be appointed as a representative in their representative capacity for a death penalty case?
As far as I know, they were. The timing of defense counsel's decision to have Mr. Ketterer waive his constitutional rights and plead guilty is disconcerting in this case. They made the decision before conducting voir dire. They did not avail themselves of an opportunity to read the jury pool before making a decision to waive the jury trial. But the unreasonableness of defense counsel's advice is most glaring when considering that their decision to have Mr. Ketterer plead guilty was made before fully investigating the case. As argued in our Proposition of Law Number 4, Section 3, and also mentioned in our reply brief under Proposition of Law Number 1, defense counsel filed a motion to have hair found in the victim's hands independently tested. The trial court granted the motion and even granted funds to have the DNA testing expedited when defense counsel failed to timely set up the testing. The specific results are not in the record, but based on what the prosecutor and defense counsel said about those results, it appears that they are indeed favorable to Mr. Ketterer. Now, it's not exactly clear when defense counsel learned the results of the DNA testing. An invoice from the lab, which is part of this record, is dated January 31st, 2004. The jury waiver and plea occurred on January 27th. If counsel knew the results of the DNA tests, which were favorable to the defense, and advised Mr. Ketterer to plead guilty anyway.
What do you mean by favorable to the defense?
That they were not Mr. Ketterer's hairs, that they raised the possibility, as the prosecutor said on the record, it raises the possibility of somebody else being involved in the crime. And Mr. Ketterer had made a statement after his initial statement to the police. He made a subsequent statement in which he said that two others were involved in the crime and another person actually went into the Sanders residence with him. And the implication of his statement is that that other person, Mary Gabbard, who has a criminal history, who supplied Mr. Ketterer with crack cocaine, is the one who was the principal offender. That's what can be gleaned from Mr. Ketterer's statement. So you have a statement that he made to the police implicating others. Then you have hair evidence that appears to be favorable to your client. I mean, it was important enough that defense counsel asked for the testing, number one, and then asked for expedited testing. But when you're going to cast aside, you know, forensic evidence that is favorable to your client, particularly when he's given a statement that others are involved in the crime, that's unreasonable. Now, if, on the other hand, defense counsel did not yet have the test results but went ahead with the plea, that's unreasonable. Under those circumstances, counsel advised their client to plead guilty to a capital indictment without knowing all the facts, without investigating all the evidence. Why ask for independent testing, have the testing expedited at a total cost to the court of $19,000, and then not wait for the results before deciding on how to proceed? The defense counsel failed to ask that the trial be continued until after the DNA test results could be obtained, but their original failure occurred when they did not get the testing done in a timely manner after the trial court granted their motion for funds for testing. They filed a motion in April 2003 to have those hairs that were found in the victim's hands preserved. In September, they actually filed their motion for funds. At a pretrial hearing on October 13th, the trial court granted their motion for funds for that independent testing. The entry was actually signed and then docketed on November 24th. Defense counsel did not have BCI deliver the hair evidence to the Cellmark lab in Dallas until January 17th, 2004. 3 months after the court indicated it was granting funds for testing. The court was willing to continue the trial date because of the cost of the expedited testing. The court recognized the importance of defense counsel having the information before going forward. But defense counsel didn't ask for a continuance. When test results come back favorable to your client, or you have reason to believe that they will, why not rethink your approach to the case? Why not at least engage in the voir dire process to assess the attitudes of the prospective jurors? It seems that defense counsel simply wanted to dispose of this case. Their decision to have Mr. Ketterer plead guilty defies any reasonable explanation under the circumstances. Defense counsel's advice in this case is made all the more unreasonable by the competency report. Dr. Bobby Hopes, the psychologist, evaluated Mr. Ketterer and concluded that he has impaired judgment and reasoning ability. Defense counsel, in effect, took advantage of Mr. Ketterer's impaired mental state. They should have realized that their client could not make a reasoned, sound decision on whether to waive his constitutional rights. He was on psychotropic medication at the time. During the jury waiver colloquy, after some prompting by the prosecutor, the trial judge asked Mr. Ketterer if he was on any medication, and he said that he was, but he couldn't remember the name of it. And the court wondered if maybe it was psychotropic medication or something just prescribed for indigestion. Mr. Ketterer didn't respond to that question. Then the judge asked him, who prescribed the medication for you? And he said, Dr. Tepe. I think that's how you pronounce it, T-E-P-E. And the judge questioned Dr. Tepe, and Mr. Ketterer said yes. There was no follow-up. The court made no further inquiry, and defense counsel shed no light on the topic. According to the competency report, Dr. Tepe is the jail psychiatrist. So Mr. Ketterer was taking medication that was prescribed by someone who treats mental illness.
Counsel, didn't the judge ask the defendant at that time whether the medication interfered with his thought process?
She did, and he said, no, I can think clearly.
Think this.
But again, consider who you're dealing with, somebody who has engaged in some very bizarre behavior before the court. The December 9th pretrial, Mr. Ketterer makes some strange statements. That's where he wants to fire his attorney because they won't enter an NGRI plea on his behalf. He goes off on a tangent talking about his bipolar disorder and his relapse into his alcohol and drug use. And the court doesn't really address his concerns. She tells him to sit down so that they can continue looking at the jury excuses or something to do with the prospective jurors. So, yes, he said that, but he said a lot of things. When he gave his statement to the police, his inculpatory statement, about 15 minutes later, after that statement was completed, he gave another statement to the police in which he indicated that he had killed while serving in combat in Vietnam. Now, Mr. Ketterer is an Army veteran, but he was never in Vietnam and he was never in combat. In his initial statement, he also said that when he walked into Lawrence Sanders' apartment, he hit him on the head with the skillet and then stabbed him. But that contradicts the coroner's findings, that the stab wounds came first, followed by blunt force trauma to the head. He also said that the following day he went back to Mr. Sanders' apartment at 4 p.m., but a bartender who testified at the plea hearing said she observed Mr. Ketterer in the bar at 4 p.m. So he's not very clear in his thinking. He vacillates between wanting to fire his attorneys, then a couple weeks later apologizing for having complained about his attorney, and then a week later expressing his dissatisfaction
with his attorney. Well, counsel, is that something that is unique to this death penalty defendant here? Doesn't that happen all the time in criminal situations where you have a defendant that might have an unrealistic view of how the case should be presented, the attorney or attorneys with experience trying to dissuade the client of the approach that the client is demanding, and a certain tension or dissatisfaction? Now, that's routine.
Certainly, that could certainly occur, but counsel's judgment in this case seems to be very unreasonable. Given the fact that they had this hair evidence, they didn't use it, they didn't follow up on it, and they had mitigating factors that they could have argued to a jury. Why would you, want to take the penalty phase to a three-judge panel instead of a 12-person jury? A 12-person jury.
There's no certainty in either approach, and to suggest that he has a better shot with a jury as opposed to a three-judge panel is merely opinion, since there's no empirical data and there's no track record on which to base that.
But it exponentially increases the chances of a life sentence. The American Bar Association guidelines are instructive here because they advise defense counsel in a capital case to be very reluctant to waive a client's trial rights when death is not taken off the table. So they recognize the importance of not pleading your client out with no benefit to your client. How were Mr. Ketterer's interests protected here? They weren't. What advantage was gained for the defense? None. There were plenty of mitigating factors that should have been argued to a jury, such as Mr. Ketterer's low IQ, 72, he's borderline. He dropped out of school in the early part of the 11th grade. He missed a lot of school due to illness. He had rheumatic fever as a child.
All of that could have been taken into consideration by the three-judge panel, though.
And they said that they did, but it's interesting. Their sentencing opinion, they don't place any weight on any of those factors. They say that the aggravating circumstances deserve great weight, but they mention all the mitigating factors that had been presented, and they don't indicate any kind of weight that was presented. And in fact, they said that...
But their determination was that the aggravating factors outweighed the mitigation.
Yes. So my question is, what was the advantage of going to a three-judge panel rather than a 12-person jury where you exponentially increase the chances of your client receiving a life sentence?
You keep arguing that, but in response to the chief's question, you said there's no empirical data to show that there's an exponential advantage. You're arguing really against your own position.
I may not be aware of empirical data, but the Arizona Supreme Court in Arizona versus Pendelli, which is cited in our proposition of law number 7, that was a case just after Ring had been decided where the trial judge was the one who found the mitigating factors. The Arizona Supreme Court said in reviewing that case that that was error because a jury could have found differently on the mitigating factors, different from a judge. So there's a recognition that judges and jurors approach cases differently, and that cases judges who've heard these kinds of arguments before become desensitized to them.
Well, is your argument also that as you increase the number of persons who make the decision, albeit juries recommend, that there's a higher chance that one of them will prevent the death penalty from being recommended?
Yes. I mean, if you have at least 12 chances to convince one person that the mitigating factors deserve great weight, that just right there increases,
that's statistically. That's better than if you have three people making the decision,
right,
to try to convince one of
three. One out of three, you have at least one out of 12.
That's pretty logical thinking.
Are you suggesting then that the state's procedure that allows for the waiver and for three judges to handle these cases is constitutionally defective?
Well, we've argued that in our proposition of law number 7. But until the United States Supreme Court addresses that issue, it certainly wasn't something that defense counsel here should have been placing their strategy on. They shouldn't have banked on that. But there is certainly an argument to be made that under the 14th Amendment, due process requires that any factor that could increase the penalty should be presented to a jury. That's what Blakely, Ring, Apprendi stand for. And there are federal statutes, death penalty statutes, that allow for that kind of procedure where the defendant can plead guilty to the judge or three-judge panel and then present the penalty phase to a jury. So it's done in other forums, and there's no reason why it shouldn't be done, especially given the 14th Amendment. But for defense counsel to say that's our reason to have our client plead guilty. I mean, they said what their strategic reason was. It wasn't because statistically we think, given empirical data, we have a better chance with a three-judge panel. You know, we've researched this, and this is the way we want to go. They said, we're doing this. We're having Mr. Ketterer plead for the tactical advantage of being able to take the penalty phase to a jury. And when that was denied, and the trial court even suggested you can concede guilt, in effect plead guilty in front of a jury, and still get your penalty phase in front of a jury.
Well,
they decided not to.
What would be the difference in those two approaches that you've just articulated?
I suppose that the reason that you would want to plead guilty in a case where you believe that the evidence is such that your client is going to be found guilty anyway, and take the penalty phase to a jury is to reduce the inflammatory or prejudicial evidence that comes out in a trial. Whether that's realistic,
I don't
know.
The difference between the option offered by the trial judge and what they took, what would be the evidentiary difference there?
Well, they could, as has been done in, you know, State versus Campbell, State versus Hessler, that you gain credibility with the jurors by conceding guilt, by saying, we're not here to say that you know, Mr. Ketterer did not do this or was not a participant in this crime.
No, I'm getting at, what would the prosecution be allowed to show if the case had gone forward in the way the trial judge suggested? Concede guilt in front of the jury. prosecutor would have still been able to lay out the basic case, would it?
Yes. I'm sure defense counsel would have objected, but yes.
The photographs. The gore. That would have been present in front of the jury.
Yes, probably over defense counsel's objection, but probably yes.
Now, was that available to the three-judge panel?
No, and in fact, what's interesting, if their thinking beyond wanting to take the penalty phase to a jury was that we'll go ahead with this plea to the three-judge panel because this kind of evidence won't be introduced, that didn't happen. The prosecutor introduced all the gory, gruesome photos that he even said were gory, gruesome, and extremely inflammatory. He argued and brought out evidence about the utensils that had been stuck into the victim's face post-mortem that was not relevant to the aggravated murder or the aggravating circumstances. They introduced a statement of Mr. Ketterer that had irrelevant, and other bad acts references in it. So they did that anyway.
So the tactical advantage was non-existent then?
Correct. All the prejudicial information came in anyway.
Well, is there any way to even eliminate that, given either forum?
Well, it should have been eliminated, given the fact that if you're conceding, guilt, if you're conceding certain issues in a case, that evidence is not relevant. And the only purpose, then, to present it is to try to inflame the trier of fact.
Whether that's legally sustainable or not, remains to be argued. That's not, you're not saying that with any conclusive position from which to argue that. In other words, the information that we're talking about, the circumstances of the crime, the nature of the victim, et cetera, would be before the jury as well as a three-judge panel.
Yes. It seems that, that would probably be the case.
And if the defense counsel, based on their certification and training, et cetera, felt that the three-judge panel, there was a better shot that the three-judge panel would be less emotionally affected by this information that would come in either forum, that could more objectively view the evidence and assess the aggravating circumstances versus the mitigating factors, that is a strategic approach to the case.
But under these circumstances, it's still—
Whether you agree with it or not, that is a strategic analysis or approach.
Yes, but a strategic decision has to be a reasonable one. And it has to be one after fully investigating the case, and that's not what was done here, given that forensic hair evidence.
Counsel, again, since nobody's providing any empirical data, but you've observed death cases over a period of time, would this be an incorrect observation, that it is extremely rare for a trial judge where a jury has recommended death to go against the jury's recommendation?
It happens, but it's rare.
In isn't it probably more rare than a three-judge panel concluding we won't recommend death?
I can't say that. I don't know that. And my opinion would be no. I don't think that it would be as rare. I think that your chances are always going to be better with a jury that judges.
That's not my question. My question is, are your chances better with getting a judge, when a jury has recommended death, to reject the jury's recommendation, or are your chances better with a three-judge panel?
Yeah, that I don't know. I really can't say. I suppose
You have an intuitive instinct about that, don't you?
Yes.
And what would that be?
I think either form is wrong. I mean, I think either form is a bad choice. Although I guess you have to look at what you have in your case. And in this case, they had mitigation evidence to take to a jury. They had two key state witnesses who are really shady characters. They had forensic hair evidence. If you have nothing to argue to a jury, then it might be a sound decision to say, we'll take this to a three-judge panel.
It's but fair to say that your trial strategy would differ from what trial counsel did in this case.
Oh, absolutely.
You would have liked to have argued this to a jury, I can tell that.
Absolutely, and I would have wanted to get the DNA test results
first. Let me ask you a different question, though, that goes to the heart of the argument I think that you're making. You did not want defense counsel to plead this defendant without securing some life sentence on penalty.
Correct.
How does that get accomplished if the trial court is not part of the plea bargain? The plea bargain being struck with prosecuting attorney, which is not binding on the court. How do you affect that result?
Well, you have to certainly work out a plea agreement with the prosecutor and approach the court with that. However,
but it wouldn't be binding on any judge, would it? That would turn plea bargain inside out in Ohio.
It wouldn't be binding, but you could, in the plea agreement, you could make the plea contingent on a sentence less than death. And if that doesn't happen, you can withdraw your plea. And that could have been made part of the plea bargain.
So you really want a dramatic change in plea bargain here because you want the court to somehow become part of the plea bargain, which isn't the law in Ohio.
I think that the defense counsel and the prosecutors, once they've reached their agreement and approached the court on it, I think you'll have a pretty good indication whether the judge is on board or not. But there's nothing to suggest that...
You want judges bound by the plea bargain struck between prosecutors and defense counsel?
They don't have to be bound by it, but the client's plea should be contingent upon a life sentence, and if that doesn't occur, then the plea is withdrawn and you proceed to trial.
Thank you, Mr. Katz.
My time is up. Mr. Ketter received ineffective assistance of counsel in violation of his Sixth Amendment right. The decision of the trial court should be reversed. His jury waiver and plea should be vacated, and this case should be remanded to the Common Pleas Court for a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Eichel.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, my name is Dan Eichel. I'm First Assistant Prosecutor of Butler County, and my co-counsel is Michael Oster, also of the Appellate Division. We intend to divide our time with Mr. Oster to address actually the bulk of the issues that have been argued by appellant's counsel. That would be issues 1 and 2 regarding the jury waiver. Issue 4 regarding ineffective assistance in respect to the jury waiver, and issue 11, the trial court's consideration of the penalty phase of the aggravating circumstances and mitigating factors. I intend to, in the first few minutes, and I shall be more brief than Mr. Oster, I hope. I will address the issue 7, part 1, which is the Ring versus Arizona issue, as well as want to make a comment in response to the questions asked by the court about statistical or empirical data versus what counsel called common sense, or what I would say speculation, that a three-judge panel is more likely than a jury to vote for death. Just in my own experience in Butler County, and that goes back to 1985, we had two previous three-judge panels trying two different cases in 1985. One was a case that the court is familiar with on appeal, Vaughn Clark Davis, who received the death penalty from a three-judge panel. The other case tried in 1985 was much like this case. It was State versus Bradford Allen Gill. The court would have had the filing as after a death indictment was issued. Of course, we're required to file the fact of the indictment, and the trial court is required to file its sentencing decision thereafter. In that case, the defendant, like in this case at bar, pled guilty as charged to the indictment charging capital aggravated murder with death penalty specifications. There was no plea bargain on the table, just as in this case. In that case, the three-judge panel, which consisted of different judges than, of course, today's judges, that being almost 20 years before this case. But in that case, the three-judge panel voted to give the least sentence possible. And that was 20 years until parole eligibility.
Well, we can talk about anecdotes all morning, but yes. Isn't it? You wouldn't disagree with the proposition that a person has a higher chance, a better chance of causing one of 12 to vote against the death penalty than one of three.
Just as a general proposition?
General proposition.
I suppose so. However, in this case, before the jury waiver was made, counsel asked for and received a draw of which particular three-judge panel was going to be drawn for this case in the event that a jury waiver would happen. And the administrative judge, who was then Judge Bressler, drew, of course, Judge Oney, presiding judge, she was already on the case, he drew two other judges, one of which was Judge Crehan. And coincidentally, Mr. Pagan was the defense counsel on a case in the year 2000 where Judge Crehan overrode, and the court says it's very rare to happen, but he overrode a jury recommendation of death. Mr. Pagan was counsel for the defendant and imposed, instead of death, a life with no parole sentence. And again, maybe coincidentally, but that defendant, the judge spoke in his sentencing decision. Judge Crehan said that he put weight on the honorable discharge of the defendant, in that case from the Army, just as we have here, one of the asserted mitigating factors. Another matter besides the Ring versus Arizona issue I wanted to address is the comment made that the some of the what was called post-mortem photographs of things that happened to the victim caused by this defendant putting foreign objects into the defendant's face, stabbing him in the chest and stabbing him in the face. We submit, and we've written in the brief, that these items of evidence were admitted because they were very relevant to the aggravating circumstance of escaping detection, apprehension, trial, or punishment for the offense first committed by the defendant in the course of these events, which was hitting him on the head, knocking him to the ground by hitting him twice with a skillet. According to his statement, Mr. Ketterer said he hit him a third time after he was down, and then used the foreign objects to hit him. It was either a knife or a fork, he didn't remember. But then, and I quote from his statement, "I can only remember stabbing him one time. I remember then when I hit him with the skillet, I was thinking if I just knocked him out, he would know who did it. So I thought I should stab him. And I don't think he moved anymore after I stabbed him. After he quit moving, I took his wallet out of his back pocket and took $60 or $70 out of it. I also went through all of his pockets to see if he had any more money." We submit that this is relevant evidence to the escape detection, and it's also part of the nature and circumstances of the way he committed this robbery. He didn't want to rob Mr. Sanders until he was down, until he was not moving. And it was only after he stabbed him, according to his own words, that Mr. Sanders stopped moving. To address the Ring versus Arizona issue, this is an interesting issue, but I submit that this court has already passed, declining to grant a leave to appeal in a case that arose out of Shelby County, State versus Brock, which is a published decision. In that, in Brock case, the Shelby County prosecutor agreed to a procedure that was requested by defense counsel, and the trial judge agreed to it. Everybody agreed to it at the trial level, that the defendant would enter a guilty plea, but also impanel a jury and have the jury decide the penalty phase. On appeal, the Court of Appeals said, this is not provided in the statute. A single judge once a guilty plea and a jury waiver is on the books, accepted by the trial court, a single judge has no jurisdiction under the statute, 2945.06, to hear the case. And he has no jurisdiction to impanel a jury for the penalty phase. It's just not provided under Criminal Rule 11, and it's not provided in the statute, 294506, which is jurisdictional. When you have a jury waiver, you have a three-judge panel, and there is no other procedure. The court should observe that the defendant's discussion of why he should have a jury decide the penalty overlooks the fact that he entered a guilty plea to the indictment. The indictment contains all the necessary facts needed for a fact finder to find that the death penalty is, that the defendant is death eligible. So by entering the guilty plea to all the specifications and the charges of aggravated murder, the guilty plea and jury waiver waives any issue about the fact-finding of the facts essential to a death verdict. This being the case, the Sixth Amendment is not implicated. Upon waiving his right to a jury trial, admitting guilt as the capital offense, with complete knowledge of the charges, as stated in the indictment, the potential punishment, which is death, and the consequences of the guilty plea, which is a three-judge panel, will decide the penalty, appellant has foregone his right to that a jury would be making any factual determinations on that indictment. There is nothing in our statutes that would allow a jury to be impaneled after a guilty plea. There is nothing in the Sixth Amendment or in the due process decisions, Apprendi, Blakely, or Ring versus Georgia, or Booker, United States versus Booker, that would require such a hybrid procedure that's not provided in Ohio law. I would point out that in Blakely versus Washington itself, the majority opinion authored by Justice Scalia specifically stated, nothing prevents a defendant from waiving his Apprendi rights. When a defendant pleads guilty, the state is free to seek judicial sentence enhancements so long as the defendant either stipulates to the relevant facts or consents to judicial fact-finding. Citations omitted. If appropriate waivers are procured, states may continue to offer judicial fact-finding as a matter of course to all defendants who plead guilty. And that's the majority of the U.S. Supreme Court speaking to the Blakely issue in Blakely, speaking to this very issue. With appellant's citation to Ring, we have to understand what Ring really held. Ring held that Arizona's capital sentencing scheme violated the Sixth Amendment because the Sixth Amendment jury trial guarantee, because it entrusted a trial judge and not a jury to make the ultimate factual determinations as to the existence of aggravating circumstances. Note, the fact-finding as to the aggravating circumstances. In Ohio, the guilty plea makes, plus the findings by the three-judge panel when a guilty plea is accepted, and evidence under State versus Green. But that is where the guilty plea is where the fact-finding is made, required, and the Sixth Amendment is waived by the defendant's jury waiver as to the elements in the indictment for aggravated murder and as
counsel,
to the elements.
Excuse me, but I don't think that the appellant's strongest argument is that there should be a hybrid system here and what happened was violative of Ohio law. I think that they go to the bigger picture of ineffective performance or assistance of counsel based on the fact that they totally took the jury out of the picture and put all their eggs in one basket, so to speak, and that was before a three-judge panel, especially given the fact that there was no consideration for the guilty plea. There was no offer by the prosecutor. There was no discussion of taking death off the table, thereby warranting the cooperation and the guilty plea that was done in this case. What is your response to that argument?
My response to that is even in their own brief under issue 7, they have raised this issue. What counsel did at the trial level was preserve this issue for this court to decide. Granted, it's my belief that this court clearly should decide that Ring versus Arizona is inapplicable. However, I certainly believe that counsel is not ineffective for raising this interesting issue. Not just interesting, but a case, an issue. If successful, the defendant could prevail in obtaining a new trial on appeal. And without doubt, that issue was preserved. In addition, we stipulated, the prosecutor in this case stipulated, it's not necessary to impanel a jury. There was a worry that for purposes of raising it on appeal here in the state's court or on appeal in by way of habeas corpus, that not impaneling a jury would somehow procedurally waive the issue. And the defense counsel obtained a stipulation from the prosecutor that that would not be the case. In other words, to answer your question, yes, I think that the ineffectiveness is not proven by the fact that Ring does not apply. I think by raising the issue and by preserving it for appeal, counsel was still doing the effective thing that trial counsel should do in making a record, preserving the issue.
Counsel, was the trial court correct in offering the option to go forward and simply with the jury and just concede or stipulate the guilt without pleading guilty?
That is certainly an option that has...
That would be a legally acceptable way to get to the jury.
Certainly is, yes.
I've
seen that done in cases in the past as well. A jury is impaneled and not guilty technically is a trial to the jury on a not guilty plea.
So the argument the defense makes on appeal here is rejecting that option was ineffective assistance of counsel.
Well, it's an option, but I don't see it the same way as counsel.
I take it you believe that the defense counsel, who was experienced, when he saw a judge that he thought had a shot at, is going to be part of the three-judge panel, that was better than presenting the case to the jury and hoping to persuade them not to impose death, or if they did, hoping to persuade the judge who was trying the case to reject the jury's finding
Yes.
or recommendation.
Yes, and with the caveat that every case is different.
Of course,
the counsel can't predict, certainly couldn't predict in this case, that one particular judge is going to vote for life and everybody, and the others might go for death. Nor could he predict that the...
Watching that unfold in your gut, were you saying, what are they doing?
No, I did not. I thought it was a viable matter that they went forward with two different viable options. They chose one versus the other and thought that they could have as good a shot at a life verdict with the three-judge panel as with a jury. Maybe even better... for the fact that knowing that the relevant evidence of some of these photographs that are not very nice to look at would go in front of that jury.
Although this same evidence did go before the three-judge panel, I understand, even
yes,
though there was a stipulation of the aggravating circumstances.
Yes, it did.
Was there an objection to the three-judge panel looking at these gruesome and gory photos?
If I'm not mistaken, the record does show that the counsel at pretrial and at the hearing objected to the entry into evidence of those exhibits. So they didn't sit on their duff and not object in this case.
And as you pointed out at the beginning, you were stating that they were relevant to the aggravating circumstances, and yet there was a plea, as you point out, too. The plea encompassed the aggravating circumstances as well as the underlying.
Yes, but as the court would understand from State versus Green, the state is obliged to present to a three-judge panel, even with a guilty plea, evidence pertaining to the issue of guilt and the aggravating circumstances. So that was our effort in this case, to present all the relevant material evidence pertaining to the guilt of the aggravated murder and guilt of the aggravating circumstances.
So if counsel had taken up the judge on the other option with the jury looking at the case and the stipulation to the aggravating circumstances, but the jury then continuing on to look at the penalty, it's your position that they still would have had that evidence in later on, even though there may be a stipulation?
Yes. Yes. A stipulation cannot prevent the admission of relevant material evidence. That's settled in State versus Maurer in the 15 Ohio State, 239. I'd like to segue into Mr. Oster's argument.
Thank you, Mr. Eichel. Mr. Oster.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, Michael Oster on behalf of the State. Your Honors, as I am running shorter on time and longer on issues, I'll try to be brief and get to what I would consider the crux of these issues that we have left. Initially, one of the discussions that has been taking place here this morning goes to whether it is better to have a 1 in 12 chance or a 1 in 3 chance. Your Honors, we're not mathematicians, we're lawyers. We make tactical decisions based upon reason, based upon sound legal judgment. I would disagree that we are better just by saying statistically you have a 1 in 12 versus a 1 in 3 chance. In cases such as this, the Supreme Court has guided what may be brilliant in one case cannot be questioned by hindsight later. To make this decision to go to a judge is to avoid gory, brutal, and sadistic facts in this case. In the case that was cited by the State of Shaw v. Martin, the case is very similar. Now, it was on a habeas appeal at the time, but in that case, the court affirmatively stated that there can be no ineffective assistance of counsel when you choose to go to a jury or a judge instead of the jury, especially in that case, they stated, considering the brutal and sadistic facts of that case. The appellant has stated here this morning that these judges are used to seeing these things. They see them every day. That's correct. And that's exactly why legally it becomes a better tactical decision, because the judges aren't as inflamed by passion. Seeing a knife stuck up under someone's throat, a fork sticking out of their face, will not enrage a judge who has seen this before as much as a jury. These facts also lead the appellant to be able to show remorse, acceptance of responsibility in this case, which this court in State v. Ashworth has said are mitigating factors that must be determined. Your Honors, in other cases, State v. Wilson, again, no ineffective assistance of counsel by going to judges rather than a jury. Furthermore, in a case out of Oklahoma, Carpenter v. State, the court looked at a similar situation and said, without a showing that the results could be different, how can we look at an ineffective assistance of counsel claim in reverse?
Well, counsel, again, one of the arguments is that they gave everything away and got nothing in return. In other words, they pled guilty before the panel. There was no consideration by the prosecutor, by the state. And death should have been taken off the table, and typically that is the quid pro quo in a situation such as this. And for not having worked that out, that is ineffective assistance per se, in addition to not waiting for the DNA hair analysis. What's your response to that?
Your Honor, initially to address that, it's two-pronged. First, there is no per se rule in any court of law that's ever been cited or ever been cited to this court, especially saying that to choose between a three-judge panel and a jury is per se ineffective assistance of counsel. What has been cited to this court? The ABA standards? That's not the U.S. Supreme Court in Strickland v. Washington saying that hindsight should not be used, or that the quote before, reasonable in one case may be unreasonable in another by the use of hindsight. Furthermore, in terms of the DNA testing, it is not before this court what those results would have been. The defense also questioned the state's expert. In State v. Faust, this court found it was not ineffective assistance of counsel to rely on cross-examination of DNA. Where is this claim more effective? It would be brought up in a post-conviction petition. because this court does not know those results. Even during the mitigation hearing, when the prosecution was willing to stipulate and allow whatever these results would have been in, tactically, the defense counsel chose not to put those in. Now, the appellant here will say that they must be favorable to them, but there's no showing of that. When they have a chance to put him in on a stipulation of the prosecutor, they choose not to. In the state's opinion, that may show that these aren't favorable results of DNA, and this court truly has no way to show that. That is why it is not ineffective, it's better situated for a post-conviction petition, and relying on this court's precedent in State v. Faust, by cross-examining the state's witness, there was no ineffective assistance of counsel in this case. Your Honors, moving to the jury waiver issue. The main presentation of the appellant in this case is that Mr. Ketterer was on a form of medication at the time that he waived his right to a jury. This case and in multiple cases, this court has looked at this situation. In State v. Turner, State v. Mink, State v. Fitzpatrick. And the clear line that has come out of this court is that if a judge is able to hear from the defendant that a medication does not leave him unable to understand the proceedings and does not leave him unable to waive this knowing, intelligently, and voluntarily, that the trial court can't accept this. And I think the facts of this case are extremely important for this court. When Prosecutor Piper initially asks the trial judge to please go through and make sure additional findings are made as to the appellant's ability to read and such, it comes out that appellant is taking medication. What is one of the very first things the appellant says to the trial judge, and I quote very briefly, quote, nothing to impair my making this decision. And the trial court didn't stop. The trial court asked the name of the medication, who prescribes it, what's the dosage, if he could read while on this medication, if he understood the advice of his counsel on this. Therefore, Your Honors, in this case, we have the appellant using foresight of thought before the trial court even goes through and makes sure the medication isn't affecting him to say, no, Judge, I know what I'm doing. This does not impair my ability to make this decision, this medication. And the trial judge goes through and further makes all the findings. That satisfies all the requirements that this court has put forth in the cases cited, as well as the Miranda-Gonzalez case out of the First District federally that's had the same basic facts. Now, the appellant will say the name of the drug was not known. And I'll concede to this court that the record says he says it's a longer name like Tala dot dot dot. He doesn't know the name. Is the name of the medication the test? No. The test is, can the appellant understand what he is doing, do it knowing intelligently and voluntarily, and did the trial court go through and make sure and protect his rights? That all happened in this case, Your Honors. Every bit of that happened, and there can be no error, and the jury waiver was constitutionally made, as it was, and as this court has affirmed in Fitzpatrick, Falaji, Mink. Your Honors, again,
counsel, why should he be put to death?
Why? I'm sorry, sir?
Why should he be put to death?
The basis upon the state executing a person goes to whether or not the aggravating circumstances outweigh the mitigating factors beyond a reasonable doubt. And in this case, they are. The fact of the matter in this case is the appellant goes to a person he considers to be his father figure. He knocks on his door, says to him, I need money for court costs. An 85-year-old man says, I don't have that money. I can't give you that. You look upset. I'll get you a glass of water. Goes to get him a glass of water. What does he receive for getting a glass of water? Multiple vicious strikes to the head with an 8 to 10-pound cast iron skillet, so hard that the skillet itself cracks, stabbed multiple times with scissors, a kitchen knife, and a fork, having a knife all the way up through, having a fork put with such force that it bends over.
He killed him.
He not only killed him, he killed them for aggravated burglary, aggravated robbery, and to avoid detection and apprehension.
Let's talk about the other side of the scales here.
The other side of the scales would be the mitigating factors.
Yeah.
I think one way to address this is to look at two very similar cases that this court has decided. The first being State v. Thomas. In Thomas, the facts are very similar. There was a burglary where a person went into the upstairs bedroom and took a hammer and struck someone in the head and killed them. Now, their mitigating factors...
I'm asking about the mitigating. I'm not...
And their mitigating factors were they had mental problems, alcohol problems, were low functioning. This court said, and I quote, "We find nothing in the nature and circumstances of this offense to be mitigating," and affirmed the death penalty.
Was he a veteran?
I'm sorry?
Was he a veteran?
He was a veteran. However, Your Honors, I think it's important for this court to note, as the trial court noted, he did not join for a patriotic reason to fight for his country. He joined because he was told by a judge, after getting in trouble, either go to the reformatory or go to the military, and he chose the military. In the state's opinion, that is not as mitigating as if someone joined up of their own volition, versus in this case, when someone joined up being told go to a reformatory or join the military.
So that's not mitigating at all.
I think it should be given very little as far as mitigation, Your Honor, due to the facts of it. The second case I would point this court to is State versus Mink. I'll start with the mitigating factors in that case. Mink had ongoing depression. He was an alcohol and crack dependent. He also cooperated with police, pled guilty, thereby helping the state. Very similar to our case. Ongoing depression is very similar. We have a mental illness. Alcohol and crack cocaine. We obviously have alcohol and crack cocaine. Pled guilty, accepted responsibility, tried to show remorse. But let's look at the facts of that case, because they're strikingly similar. Mink killed his parents. In our case, we have a killing of a father figure. After killing them, he robbed them, took their possessions, and tried to sell them for crack. In our case, he robs a person he considers to be a father figure, steals his possessions, and tries to go sell them for crack. This court affirmed, finding the aggravating circumstances outweighed those mitigating factors, which are extremely similar to this case at bar.
Thank you.
Furthermore, Your Honor, in briefly addressing the issue as to the B3 factor of the mental illness versus the B7, which is the catch-all factor, the appellant has stated that there was uncontroverted testimony that this B3 factor was present. Well, the state disagrees. As I'm running out of time, I'll be very brief in looking at some of these statements. But the doctor has said, well, it's more likely than not. And he said, well, it's my opinion, but he could have just wanted the money and did what he had to do to get the money. He said, that's not impossible at all. Very importantly, the appellant has been diagnosed with feigning or faking illnesses in the past. That was brought up continuously by the state in this case in terms of everything from the appellant cannot be believed by the psychologist. Finally, Dr. Hope said he wasn't delusional at the time, and he could have believed the victim was lying and just became angry and did this. Your Honor, as I see I'm out of time, if there are no further questions from this court, the state will request that the sentence and the finding of guilt be affirmed by this court.
Thank you, Mr. Oster.
Thank you.
Ms. DeKatz, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
There's a lot to rebut, and unfortunately not the time to do it. A couple of points I would like to make is that in terms of the DNA evidence, the prosecutor misstated the record. The defense counsel said that they weren't going to be introducing that evidence. The prosecutor said that had defense counsel introduced that evidence, the state would have put on rebuttal witnesses, jailhouse inmates, to rebut the DNA evidence because of the possibility of somebody else being involved in the crime. So that shows that the results were favorable to Mr. Ketter. Also, the jury waiver occurred before any three-judge panel was chosen. So the defense counsel did not know who the panel would consist of beyond the trial judge at the time that the jury waiver was signed and accepted. Also, the utensils that were stuck into the victim's face, the coroner said that that was after the victim was already dead, so that's not to escape detection because at that point the victim is dead. I will say then briefly that Mr. Ketterer's trial attorneys advised him to plead guilty to the entire indictment without securing a life sentence. They carelessly tossed aside his constitutional rights in a death penalty case where forensic evidence seems to indicate that someone else was also involved in the crimes. This court should be concerned about that. Today, in a few minutes, it's probably undergoing right now, the state of Ohio is set to execute a man. It seems that state-sanctioned execution has become commonplace and receives only a passing glance anymore. Having witnessed an execution, I can say that the event is sobering. Our laws recognize that death is different, The United States Supreme Court mandates that constitutional protections be in place, and we must stop to consider the individual.
You need to sum up.
We may not have walked in Mr. Ketterer's shoes. We may not fully understand what goes on inside his head. We may not have wrestled with his demons, but we should all be concerned about how his attorneys, in effect, abandoned him and tainted the process. And we should be concerned that he could go to his death in this manner. More is required of a capital attorney than what defense counsel did here. Thank you.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.